Welcome to the Knowledge for Teachers podcast. My name is Brendan Lee, and on this podcast, I speak with researchers, teachers, and experts about what evidence-informed practice is and the nuances involved with actually implementing effective and sustainable school-based education. Before we start, I would like to acknowledge the land that we are all on today. I am on the beautiful land of the Darug and Gundungurra people in the Lulgbalee Mountains of New South Wales, Australia. I would like to pay respect to the elders both past, present, and emerging, who are the traditional custodians of this country. As we learn together today, I would like to extend that respect to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people listening today. This land always was and always will be the land of the First Nations people. In this episode of the Knowledge for Teachers podcast, I speak with Sarah Power. Sarah is an associate professor in the Department of Special Education at the University of Texas at Austin. She has pretty much dedicated her whole career to researching word problems in maths, and boy did I enjoy nerding out with her over this. Learning about evidence-based maths instruction has been my passion project for the last few years, and Sarah has long been on my list of people to speak with. She has also contributed to a couple of papers that have recently been released for the Centre for Independent Studies, and we touch on those as well. However, the main focus is word problems, and we go through everything from attack strategies to the dangers of using keywords and delve into the world of schema instruction. If you care about helping your students improve their ability to solve word problems, then this episode is for you. So, without further ado, here is my conversation with Associate Professor Sarah Powell. Really excited to be talking to Sarah Powell today. Sarah, are you able to tell us a bit about your journey into the position that you're in today?
Yeah, thanks, Brennan. It's really, really fun to be here. Yeah, so I'm a former elementary school trained teacher and a former kindergarten teacher. And how I got to where I am today is that I had started a master's degree program in school administration. I thought one day I'd like to be a school principal, kind of like you. And at that time, I ended up taking a research assistant position in a department of special education. I was at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, basically just to pay my bills. And in that research assistant position, I started spending time collecting data in school-based settings for a research project focused on a first grade math peer tutoring project. And I really liked that. And I thought it was really fun working with teachers and working with students, particularly working with students who were having a hard time with math sometimes. And then I just continued to do that. And then I taught school and then came back to work in the research world. And then eventually that led to doing my PhD at Vanderbilt. And I worked with a professor who's pretty well known in the United States, Lynn Fuchs, who was doing just a lot of math research. And then we started doing things at third grade around word problem solving or second grade around computation. And I was spending every day in school. So it still really filled my cup around working with students and working with teachers. Yet then we went back to the office and said, does this work? If not, why not? How can we change it? Take it back into the schools, see if this is better for teachers to use with their students. And so after I finished my PhD, I started an assistant professor position at the University of Virginia. And then 10 years, I came to the University of Texas at Austin. So now I live and work in Austin, Texas, and have a pretty large research team where we do a lot of research here in the Texas area and across the United States. And that has led me to where I am. So I still focus on mathematics. I still focus a lot on school-based research, thinking that that's a really good way to understand what are some of the things that are going on in schools and what are some of the ways that we might be able to improve some of those practices. And that's why I'm here today.
Yeah, amazing. So in a way, you kind of fell into the field of research.
I totally fell into it. Yeah, I don't meet that many people that grew up and knew they wanted to be a researcher. But a lot of people that I work with grew up and knew that they probably wanted to do something in education. And I don't know if I necessarily grew up when I was a little kid or in middle school or high school knowing that, but both of my parents are teachers, and English teachers, not math teachers. Yeah. And then my dad's mother and my dad's grandmother were both school teachers as well. So I think it's a little bit of the family business. And so when I went to college and was trying to root around and figure out what major and what program seemed the most interesting to me, I took in my sophomore year an intro to education class. And it was the first time I was ever in a class that was like, okay, this is what I should be doing. And so then I just found research. And for me, doing research in schools was really cool. So even to this day, I really like spending time with the teachers that we're working with or the students that we are tutoring. And but then really being able to understand if those things that we're doing with them are helpful strategies or not.
Yeah, really interesting. What's something that you've changed your mind about throughout your career?
This is a really interesting question, and maybe it's one that we'll end up talking about throughout the session. So when I went to college in the late 90s here in the United States. And one of the books that I remember from my education program was called like The Constructivist Teacher. And so that was a big approach that I learned. And that's, you know, when I was in schools and doing my student teaching, that was what I was thinking of how students should learn. But in many ways, my entry into a master's program was somewhat fueled by me and my student teaching placement. I remember I was teaching in a kindergarten first grade classroom for students who are 5, 6, 7 years old. Mm-hmm. And there were a few kids who were still not reading. And I was like, I don't know how to teach them to read, you know, and I'd taken a few years of coursework at that point, but I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not equipped to be a teacher because a lot of people here in the US graduate from college and go be a teacher. I graduated from college and went and did a master's program in which I thought I could do some stuff around principal leadership, but I also took some classes about how do you actually teach reading. And it's kind of interesting to me now, 20 years later, all I do is mathematics. And I now realize I probably had really very little idea of how to teach mathematics, but by approaching reading in a very systematic way around phonics, then I started to think about, well, that's probably a good approach to the teaching of mathematics, and then read a lot more about it. So many of my conversations now kind of like lean away from constructivist, I'll say pedagogy in classrooms and being more explicit with that instruction, particularly when students struggle with math. But that, like where I came from and then where I've ended up is probably, you know, pretty different along that continuum of instruction.
Yeah. What do you think it is about that constructivist approach, which is quite attractive to a lot of educators?
Oh, well, I remember reading that book and was like, this is awesome, right? And I really like the idea that children are really active in learning. And, you know, I think that's one of the misnomers around what, you know, people call explicit or systematic instruction is that students are just sitting there and, you know, getting this information and mimicking it. But when we design a lot of interventions for teachers to use and to use with students, you know, we're being very explicit with our instruction, but the students are overly involved and engaged and participating and doing the math alongside the teacher. So I think that like with the constructivist approach, which there's probably a time and place for that, but most likely after students have a strong foundation in whatever math content that they're working on, it's sexy and it sounds cool and it's different from what we've done before. And I think we're always trying to find, you know, what will help all students access mathematics? And so it's like, oh, let's try this different approach. But in many ways, that goes against a lot of things that research has told us about how people learn. You know, people don't really learn through kind of like creating a lot of their own knowledge, but we really learn in a pretty systematic way with a lot of modeling and a lot of practice and a lot of feedback. So what do you think? Why do you think that that is an approach that some people like to pursue?
Yeah, I think it's probably a combination of things where, yeah, I agree with you. It's that kind of romantic view of, you know, like we want our students to discover things for themselves and, you know, it's going to stick better that way. I think it also has a bit to do with, like, this is one thing I've been thinking about recently around how it's, as a teacher who lacks that actual content knowledge, the pedagogical content knowledge as to how to teach, you know, that subject, it's easier to teach that way, you know, where you kind of
set a
problem or an activity and you get the kids to try to work it out for themselves. Yeah, for a lot of teachers who don't know how to teach that content, it's actually just easier that way. And you might, I don't know if you consciously make that decision, but yeah, it's something which I've just been thinking about recently.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I hadn't really thought about that before, but that resonates with me for sure.
Look, you've released a couple of excellent papers for the Center for Independent Studies in the last 12 months or so. The first one was Maths Practices. The most recent one was Maths Practices You Can Count On. And previously there was the Myths That Undermine Maths Teaching. Yeah. What are some of the key points that you'd like to emphasize for teachers?
Oh, well, first off, thank you for the Center for Independent Studies for asking us to write that content. It's been a real pleasure to work with their team there, and I feel that what they've they, that these reports have been very popular, downloaded, I think, tens of thousands of times. So I think teachers, not just in Australia but around the world, have been really interested in these as good conversation starters about effective math or maths practices, as you all say. I'm coming to Australia next week, and I'm like, okay, I gotta say maths and gotta be ready for that. I think it won't be lost in translation if I let's see from the document about the math myths. We just really designed that to be a conversation starter to think about, are some of these things going on at your school, and are they as efficient and productive as they could be? One of the things that we talked about in the document was this idea around productive struggle. This is a real hot topic in mathematics, I think, around the world. The idea is that students should have some type of struggle. It should be productive. And as they learn mathematics, and if you're tutoring one-on-one, we talk about this in the paper, you're almost likely engaging students in productive struggle and you don't even know it. And this is, knowing right where the student is and being able to move them forward from there and giving them a task that's a little bit challenging but not too challenging, and so on. But sometimes teachers will say, oh, I'm doing this task because it's getting students to engage in productive struggle. But if you've got a task for 20 or 25 or 30 students in your class, it's likely going to be too challenging for some, too easy for others. And so really the enactment of productive struggle at a classroom level is I have yet to see a teacher pull that off effectively so that all students are benefiting from the activity. And so it's just kind of very hard to do. And so instead of saying like, oh, this activity is around, to engage students in productive struggle, let's really think about understanding where our students are and then meaningfully engaging tasks for students. And it might be small groups of students in your class so that all students are really meaningfully engaged in the mathematics where it isn't too hard and it's not too easy, but it is moving them along that math continuum as they should be. So that was one of the points that we talked about in that paper. And we also talked about math anxiety and some other hot topics in education and just getting people to consider, well, what is the research base to support this practice? And are there some ways that we could be maybe better supporting mathematics in the classroom? So that's that document. And then the one that we just released in the last, I think, about month or so is the maths practices that you can count on. And in there, we took five research validated practices around supporting students, especially when students struggle with mathematics. And so in that guide, we talked about the emphasis of mathematics vocabulary in the classroom, the use of representations in the classroom, whether that's hands-on tools or virtual tools. And the guide has some different visuals that are important to emphasize in the classroom, such as number lines. You'll see those in there. The guide also talks about being systematic with our instruction, building fluency with students in a really intentional way. And then there's also a section on effective word problem in instruction and what that looks like. So that's meant to be, I think the first guide was like, okay, what's going on in your school? Let's talk about some things. We probably got many things that are going on that are great, but are there some practices that we could improve upon? And so then the second guide is thinking about, well, here are some research validated practices that we should be using in mathematics. And there's probably more to add to that list. We only talked about five, which are five that appear in the research time and time again, but that's meant to be a good conversation starter so that as teachers are teaching or as administrators are going in and doing math observations and talking with teachers, it could be like, all right, how are you emphasizing vocabulary? How are you helping students build fluency? Which representations are you using this week? So that's meant to be a guide as to these are some of the things that would be really great to see in the classroom, particularly when we're thinking about supporting mathematics.
Yeah, look, I think they're both terrific documents and really helpful for teachers, particularly like you said, as those conversation starters and just giving some pointers around like where they can start to look at making those small kind of incremental changes to their practice. Look, I'll put
And as a
the
reminder, they're both downloadable for free. So yeah, hopefully people can find them and share them and they get the conversations going.
Yeah, I'll definitely put the links in the show notes, and yeah, I think they're really useful documents. And look, we could speak about them, you know, for a whole podcast episode. But today, I really wanted to focus in on, you know, something which has pretty much been a focus of your whole career is looking at word problems. And yeah, look, I find it really interesting. You know, like we have over here in Australia, we've got our standardized test being NAPLAN, and for the numeracy part of it, it's pretty much all word problems.
Oh yeah, that's the exact same thing here in the United States. Yeah.
Yeah. So really, it's a really vital skill for our students to be able to do, but it's probably a little bit misunderstood by teachers as to how to actually teach it. You know, what it is, what it requires our students to actually know. And so, I really wanted to dig into that today with you.
Okay.
And yeah, hopefully we can kind of answer some of those questions for teachers. So just before we kind of dig into the nitty gritty, like just so we're on the same page, there's two terms which are kind of used interchangeably, but I just want to discuss as to like the similarities and differences between the two. So the terms being word problems and problem solving. Yeah, what would you say the differences and the similarities are?
Yeah, great question. So I would suggest that problem solving is kind of the umbrella term of like things where students are solving problems in mathematics. So some people would say students are everything in mathematics is problem solving, but sometimes it's more through text-based scenarios or orally presented problems to students where they have to engage in the mathematics in some way and do a task or answer a question. But I would say it's kind of like the larger umbrella of problem solving. But then within that, as a part of that umbrella term, word problems, I would define as text-based scenarios where students have to answer a question that's presented to them. And sometimes it might not actually be a question. Sometimes it might be, solve the problem and describe how you solve the problem or which of these expressions represents the word problem. I guess that would be a question there. But then within word problem solving, there's typically kind of like two different types of word problems that we see that students are asked to set up and solve in textbooks and, as you said, and, state or national exams. And so of those two, which are word problems, there's these routine word problems, which is what I focus a lot on. These are word problems such as, Brendan has 5 cookies, Sarah has 6 cookies. How many cookies do they have altogether? And so students have to read that text. They have to realize the story is about cookies. They have to figure out, adding Brendan's and Sarah's cookies. And then they have to produce a response to figure out, altogether they have 11 cookies. When we look at state and national exams, usually about half of the problems on those tests relate to these routine word problems. And these are hard for students to set up and solve. There's a lot that goes into the setting up and solving of those routine word problems. But then there's also another set of word problems that are directive. And I kind of call them directive. I've talked to a few colleagues who somewhat agree with that naming. You might have other ways of talking about these. But in these directive word problems, they direct students to answer a question. So for an example, it might be which of these fractions is equivalent to 3/8, or which of these two shapes are quadrilaterals, or which of these expressions, represents a number plus 3, right? So there's not information, there's not numbers from the problem that students have to take and manipulate. Instead of they're just having to read this text-based scenario and answering the question. And so again, that you have to read and understand, but there's kind of an extra element to routine word problems that you don't see in directive word problems, where then you have to really interpret, well, what am I going to do in this story? What's going on? And then how would I be able to take these numbers and work with them in order to be able to answer the word problem prompt? So I'd say problem solving at the top, and then word problems. And then within word problems, you've got these routine word problems and the directive word problems. And there is another third type of word problems that are most often referred to as non-routine word problems. You don't usually see these on like state and national tests. And these would be word problems that have multiple entry points, perhaps multiple answers, and they would be like longer tasks for students to engage in word problem solving. And I don't focus that much on those because students don't run into those that frequently, but they do see all the time the routine word problems and the directive word problems. And so that's where we spend almost all of our time on instruction.
Yeah, look, you know, you've mentioned a couple of those, the difficulties with word problems around how we've got these different types of word problems.
Yeah.
Like what other things can kind of cause students to really struggle with actually answering them?
Yeah. So I'll just focus a lot on routine word problem solving, and this applies to directive word problem solving. But so reading the problem is a real barrier for a lot of students, and tied to that is understanding the vocabulary of these problems. We've looked at like the average word count of text-based problems for students in grades 3, 4, 5 or 6, 7, 8. And, you know, sometimes students have to read 22 words to answer a single question. And in the later grades, it's sometimes 27 or 35 average words. And so if a student is answering 30 of these, you know, over in the day period or maybe over several days period, they're reading hundreds of words to be able to understand what these problems are about. So reading and understanding the vocabulary, both the math vocabulary, for example, if it says fewer or per, and then there's just general vocabulary. What does it mean if this is a cupcake? What does it mean if I share something? There's a lot of mathematical language and general language that students have to understand to really be able to know what the problem is asking them to do. Then beyond that, once they figure out, okay, well, this problem is asking me to do this, well, what information do I need? What numbers and units do I need? What information do I not need? You know, sometimes these problems have irrelevant information. And then sometimes problems have a pictograph or bar graph or pie chart that students have to use in order to be able to find the information they need. So there's sometimes like this data interpretation piece that is put into these word problems as well. And like all that stuff we just talked about, Brendan, isn't even solving the problem, right? So then it's like, well, what am I going to do? What's my strategy? Am I going to use a number line? Am I going to use a bar model? Do I think I'm going to add, subtract, multiply, or divide? And then doing the mathematics. So, you know, taking your multiplication skill and applying it in that word problem solving scenario, that can be a challenge as well. And there are probably other challenges. I know a lot of teachers talk about persistence. Students, especially with multi-step problems, not always realizing that they're not done with the problem, that there's still more that they have to do. So there's probably other challenges, but I'd say reading, understanding the content, and being able to identify the information and then being able to make a plan and solve it, those are some of the key challenges for students.
Yeah, and look, and I know another one which you've done a lot of research on is the problem with using the keywords to solve word problems.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, an area that a lot of teachers kind of go to first is, you know, look for those keywords. And so, like, what have you found is the issue there?
Yeah. So great, Gray, I'm so glad you brought this up. So the whole thing about keywords, particularly around keywords tied to a specific operation. So I was in a fifth grade classroom where a teacher said, oh, whenever you see share, that means you divide. Now in the word problems that they had in the class, sure, that was true. But I could also have a situation where, you know, I bake 20 cookies and I share 10 with Brendan. Well, that's not a situation where I end up dividing. And so a lot of teachers have found through the beauty of the internet keyword posters. So these are posters where they'll usually have the four operations on them, and then they'll have words that mean addition, words that mean subtraction, multiplication, and division, and so on. But really, there are no words that mean the same operation all the time. And probably the biggest one that we see is total. You know, a lot of kids will say, oh, total means you add. Well, you'll see the word total in subtraction scenarios. You'll see the word total in multiplication scenarios. So there's never a time where a single word or term means the same operation. And this was something that, I mean, you do a lot of professional learning with teachers, and you've probably talked with teachers about this. And I had too. You know, I was always standing up there saying, like, don't use keywords tied to operations. But since my day job is as a researcher, I had the opportunity to work with a team my colleagues, Jessica Nam Kong and Sheen Lin, and we collected a bunch of standardized test released items. In the United States, it's pretty easy to find, like, what did the students answer last year? And so we ended up with a lot of single-step problems and a lot of multi-step problems. And then we investigated this keyword approach. And so what we did is we sat down and we found whether word problems had keywords in them. And then if they did, we solved the problem by keyword. So if we saw share, we divided. If we saw fewer, we subtracted. And I'll tell you, that was a little harder to do because your adult brain is saying, no, 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 that's not the correct answer. And then it was like, no, this is how a student would do this if they were relying on the keyword strategy. Yeah. So we ended up finding that for single step word problems, depending upon the problem type, keywords work around like 28 to 80% of the time. So a little more than 50% of the time, keywords can help you with those single step problems. But for multi-step problems almost 100% of the time have a keyword in them. And then keywords will help kids solve the problem correctly less than 10% of the time. Wow. And so if we're thinking about teaching math for the long haul, you know, and so I think particularly when I talk with kindergarten and first and second grade teachers, a lot of keywords work pretty well there. But starting in third grade, when students are 8 and 9 years old, they're going to start setting up and solving multi-step problems, where if I see total, I'm not going to add, or if I see share, I'm not going to, you know, divide. And so we've really got to set students up for long-term success with word problem solving instead of just finding these tricks. You know, we talk all the time in mathematics how let's avoid the tricks. Let's not just memorize these tricks and try to apply them. Well, the keywords tied to operations is a total trick that is not going to have long-term staying power for students at all.
Yeah. So how can we support students' understanding of word problems through language?
Yeah. So it's a more difficult route than putting a poster on the wall and saying, hey, find that word and tie it to that operation. So there's two things that come from the research that have a real strong research base to support their use. And I would propose doing these things simultaneously. So the first is using like a metacognitive strategy. This is a step-by-step overall process for approaching a word problem. I typically call these attack strategies with kids. Like, okay, we're going to attack this word problem with this strategy. And some common attack strategies we see used in US schools are like solve, where students study a problem by reading it. They organize information, they line up a plan, they verify the plan, and then they examine their answer. And then another one that we use quite frequently is UPS check or UPSC, where students understand a problem by reading it, make a plan, solve, and then go back and check their work. When students have a metacognitive strategy, it gives them like a starting point and then a process for, as I said, approaching the problem. Because I'm going to guess you've met some students in Australia that they look at a word problem and they're just like, I don't know, right? They just don't even know where to start. But if students have that metacognitive strategy and they know the first thing, okay, first thing I have to read it. Okay, let's do that. Next, I've got to think about, well, what's going on in this story? You know, what are we, you know, putting things together? Are we putting things into groups? Like, what's going on? And then they could be like, okay, well, now I've got to make a plan. I see that I've got these groups and I'm putting them together. And so then you can make a plan and then you can take the numbers from the problem and put them into an equation or graphic organizer or some other way of organizing the information. And so it just gives students who may not always have it access for working through the word problem. So that's one big research-based strategy. The second is to focus on the concepts of the word problems. And this is probably not a surprise for any of your listeners. I'm sure many times you talk about this, not just procedural understanding of things, but also conceptual understanding. And so the idea here is that we don't want to just define word problems like, oh, you just add, right? Well, adults know that because they're expert problem solvers, but that's not always apparent to students. And so here, thinking about, well, what's conceptually going on in this story? Are we comparing things in this story? Do we have groups with an equal number in each group? Is there something that's changing in this story? And so there are just a handful of concepts that we see emphasized in word problems again and again and again. And so if we can help students realize that And so then they can say, oh, in this story, I'm comparing two things. And so then it doesn't matter what they're comparing, and it doesn't matter what numbers they're using, whether it's whole numbers or rational numbers. If they're like, oh, in this story, I'm comparing, and they know how to approach a word problem where you are comparing, then it makes the word problem solving process just a lot more accessible for students. And it's really heavy on the concept behind the word problem instead of just like, just do this math. And so as we're striving to really help students develop that conceptual and procedural knowledge in tandem, emphasizing the concept of the word problem, which I often refer to as the schema. Some people call it the structure or the problem type. That's going to help students, again, think about being better problem solvers in the long haul instead of just learning these tricks or strategies that may only work in the grade level that they're in.
Yeah, cool. All right. So let's backtrack a bit and look at attack strategies in a bit more detail. Yeah. So, you know, like what sort of, like you mentioned a couple of those acronyms that we can be following.
Yeah.
There's a lot out there. So what are the key mechanisms that we should be ensuring are a part of those steps?
That's a really good question. There are a lot of attack strategies out there. I'm probably familiar with at least 2 to 3 dozen, and I'm sure there's more than that. I'll always kind of suggest I don't really care which attack strategy you use.
Yeah.
I just care that when teachers and students are setting up and solving these routine word problems, and it also works for directive problems, that they just use it every time. So if you see a word problem, you're like, oh, I have to solve it, or I have to use UPS check, or another popular one here in the US is R cubes. The primary thing that any attack strategy has is that it needs to ask students to read the problem first. A lot of students skip that step, and that particularly happens when in earlier grades, students sometimes just end up plucking numbers from a problem and adding them together. So you don't always have to read the problem. But as we move through the grades and the word problems get more complex, it's absolutely essential that we read. So I'd say reading and then just having a general process that can work across different problems. And so that's where I like UPS check, where I'm like, I'm going to read it. I'm going to make a plan. I'm going to then solve it. And then finally, I think a really important part of the word problem attack strategy is that I go back and check my work. Is this reasonable? You know, did I do the math correctly? So that students, and that's kind of how adults probably approach word problem solving. They may not be able to verbalize that. I mean, at that point, our attack strategy is such an internal thing that we don't even put words to it. Mm-hmm. But when we have novice problem solvers and students who are struggling with word problem solving, which is in the United States, the majority of students in schools, like we've got to put a name to it and we've got to externalize that for them so that they know like, oh, okay, I know at least I should read it, make a plan, solve and check. Like if you've got that down, that's a good first approach to the word problem. And then we can layer in that conceptual understanding piece so that students really understand what the problem is about.
Yeah. And so how and when should these attack strategies be taught? How early should we introduce it?
Yeah. So there's some research that uses these in kindergarten and first grade. Now, a lot of the times the problems are orally presented, but you know, even if the teacher is maybe showing a problem or saying like, okay, I have a story to tell you today. All right, first let's read this story together. Likely the teacher is reading it, but maybe the teacher's pointing to the words, right? So it's like, okay, you know, Brendan has 6 cookies, Sarah has 5 cookies, you know, and so they read it and like, okay, then I'd ask, well, what's going on in this story? You know, what are we focused on? Well, we're focused on Brendan, we're focused on Sarah, we're focused on these cookies, right? And then they could say, okay, well, what would be a way that we could answer that question about how many cookies they have altogether? So whether students are reading the problem or they're orally presented and teachers are really reading the problem, what the teacher is doing there is the attack strategy. Mm. Now, they may not formally talk about that with 5-year-olds, but by the time students are 7 and 8 years old, they can say, oh, okay, let's read it. Let's make a plan. Let's solve. Let's go back and check our work. And then maybe you actually introduce that. And a lot of times our students have the attack strategy on posters in the classroom or on bookmarks that are on their desk so that they can remember, oh, every time I see this word problem, these are the things that I'm going to do to work through that.
Yeah. So, you know, even in those early years as a teacher, you're able to use your kind of think aloud and you know, the teacher talk to develop their metacognitive strategies.
Yeah.
Yeah, really useful. I do find it funny that you're talking about Brendan eating lots of cookies, because at the previous episode I had Dr. Nathaniel Swain talking about Brendan eating lots of ice cream. So
I know some people are critical about word problems. They're like, oh, they shouldn't always be about food. But there's nothing better than a food-based word problem to get students very interested in the word problem. Yeah, so...
Cool. So, yeah, look, we've just discussed that we've got these attack strategies that, and it's really useful to be teaching students that to actually have these strategies so that they can go through the steps when they are addressing problems, and that they're able to then understand conceptually what's going on. So, like when we're looking at schema instruction, you know, or that problem type instruction, what sort of things should we be looking out for? What should be taught? When should it be introduced?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, these are such good questions. It's so fun to talk to you about this. So this also should start very early on. And actually, early grades teachers are likely doing schemas, but maybe not aware of it, or maybe not naming it specifically. So the schemas really come, especially the addition and subtraction schemas, really come from decades of literature about how students develop knowledge around addition and subtraction. So in the earliest grades and before students enter school, so maybe pre-kindergarten, preschool, or even just in home environments, students do a lot of early addition and subtraction. And in addition, students learn to addition as putting things together. And then you can kind of move to this point where you can do addition as adding on. So with the put together model, usually you're counting all of the things that you're putting together. So the 6 cookies and the 5 cookies, and you put them all together. But you could also say, well, what if Brendan already had these 6 cookies and then I gave him 5 more? So there I'm starting with 6 and counting on. And this really directly relates to finger counting, where it's more efficient to finger count from, you know, the greater addend and add on than it is to count all of your fingers all the time. So there's these 2 concepts that we emphasize in addition, whether we're using fingers or manipulatives or stories. And then we also see the same thing in subtraction. There's 2 concepts there that students have to learn to really understand what subtraction is all about. So the first one that students usually learn is this idea of separating from a set or changing a set. So I might have 10 cookies on a plate and I eat 4 of them. So that number of cookies is changing. This is often why early grades teachers talk about subtraction as taking away. I have 10 and I'm taking away from that set. But subtraction also should be interpreted as, well, there's these 2 different sets. You know, maybe it's that Brendan has 10 markers, Sarah has 6 markers. How many more markers does Brendan have than Sarah? Or how are fewer markers does Sarah have than Brendan? So in that situation, there's 2 different sets. They are distinct sets, and we're comparing them for a difference. And so these things are named in the standards. You know, it talks about putting together, adding on, taking from, and comparing. And so teachers are doing this. But then once you start to put these stories to it, then as we move to 1st, 2nd, 3rd grade, then we're starting to formally see these schemas in play. And you're probably still using a lot of manipulatives and drawings to exhibit what's going on in these schemas. But then so throughout the elementary grades and the middle school grades, pretty much any routine word problem where students end up adding or subtracting falls into, I'll say, 3 schemas. So putting things together, comparing things, or having one set that either increases or decreases. And it's pretty amazing. You see those with fractions problems, with decimal problems, with integers. And yet we're always, are we putting together? Are we comparing? Or is there one set that changes? So it starts very early on. And then just as students move through the grades, we end up formalizing the language around those. Those are the additive schemas. And then there's a set of schemas that are multiplicative in nature that students typically start to learn around 8 or 9 years old.
Yeah. And so as we actually teach these, would you kind of break it down like one by one and go like, all right, I'm going to show you a bunch of, you know, putting together problems, and then, you know, maybe a couple of weeks later we're going to look at some comparing.
Yeah, for sure. We've done some, like, I've done whole class work as early as 2nd grade, and then some colleagues here in the United States have done some whole class schema work as early as 1st grade. And yeah, we introduce each schema separately. Typically, we introduce the put together or what we call total schema. Other people call that part, par, whole, or combine. We introduce that one first. And there's different variations of these schemas. So there's a total in the total schema. There's problems where students are asked to find the total. So Brendan has 6 cookies. Sarah has 5 cookies. How many cookies do they have altogether? But there's also a variation of total problem where students are given the total and a part and they have to find another part. So for example, Brendan and Sarah have 11 cookies. If Brendan has 6, how many cookies does Sarah have, right? In that problem, it doesn't matter what that unknown is. If there's parts that are put together for a total, it is a total problem. And so we typically introduce a few days where students are solving problems with the total unknown. And then pretty quickly, once students kind of get it, oh, I'm putting these parts together for a total. And I do want to just say there are total problems that have 3 or 4 parts. I always think, I'm talking right now about 2 parts, but many total problems have 3 parts put together for a total or 4 parts and so on. But then pretty quickly, you want to say, okay, let's look at that same situation. What if we're given the total and we know one part and we have to find the other part? And then so then once that's in rotation, kind of going back and forth between times where the total is missing, times where a part is missing. And then probably, as you say, after a few weeks, we usually do about 7 to 9 days on a specific schema. Then we introduce the next one. And now we're going to look at a new problem today. And let's think about, are we putting parts together for a total or are we comparing amounts for a difference? And so then once that comes into play, then students should be practicing those 2 schema. And then probably 2 or 3 weeks later, introduce the third. And then if you're an upper grades teacher, a few weeks later, introduce the 4th schema and the 5th schema. And so that, by hopefully the end of the fall of the school year, students have been introduced to all of the schema. And then as you should practice problem solving every day, they're identifying, well, what's going on in this story? And, what's the action? I think that's what's really important there. And then they know, like, oh, I know how to solve a problem where we put together, or I know how to solve a problem where we have equal groups. And then pretty soon, especially 3rd, 4th, 5th grade, and in the middle school, we see these multi-step problems that are often multi-schema problems. So maybe the first thing you're asked to do is figure out the total number of cookies. And then what happens if they give 3 to their friend? Well, then you're figuring out a change in the cookies. And all of it is really conceptually driven. So talking about those schemas is just a real good way of helping students just not be worried about, well, what do I do here? Do I subtract or do I add? That's really secondary. Primary is understanding the schema of the problem.
Yeah. And so, you kind of mentioned it there, but I see it as being a really good opportunity to use the interleave practice principle, where you're able to, to really kind of see, are they understanding the difference between the types of problems?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
And, one of the things we do is might be a little kind of deep into the schemas here.
Go for it.
But we will, let's say that students know now total schema and different schema. We will write a problem that's about the same thing. So here's a total problem that's about, white dogs and brown dogs and how many there are altogether. Then we also have a problem that's about, oh, there's this many brown dogs and that many white dogs. How many more brown dogs are there than the white dogs? So we write a lot of problems that are about the same thing and maybe use the same numbers. Mm. And those are really good conversation starters for but what's going on in this story and how does that differ from what's going on in that story? And this is also an opportunity. I bet a lot of your teachers are doing things with numberless word problems. That's a great way to introduce the schemas. Well, Brendan has some cookies. Sarah has some cookies. How many do they have altogether? Right? I'm not even adding the number, thinking about numbers at that point. Just well, what's going on? And versus Brendan has some cookies. He has more than Sarah. Well, there we're comparing instead of putting together. And you could also, do word problems that are already solved. So you could say Brendan has 6 cookies. Sarah has 5 cookies. They have 11 cookies altogether. And just to talk about that. And that's a good place to use manipulatives to represent that. Use drawings, use graphic organizers to really represent what's going on in the word problem. So there's a lot of supporting strategies that you can bring in here that, just as you say, with interleaved practice, numberless word problems and solved problems and worked examples. These are all really good strategies to bring into the word problem solving to then eventually get students to the point where they're answering this question that has been asked of them in the word problem prompt.
Yeah. And you mentioned before around how it's really important that students are completing word problems daily.
Yeah.
What have you found when they are having the opportunity to do it daily?
Yeah, well, we've done some whole class whole class instructional programs, and we've done a lot of small group and individual tutoring programs around this word problem stuff. And the students do receive, I would say, daily or almost daily word problem practice. At least 3 times a week is probably key, and that's important just because, as you probably agree, math is learned through practice. And if we aren't practicing something regularly, whether that's how to count or how to use the Pythagorean theorem, students aren't going to really become fluent with that thing. And that's the same thing with word problems. I've seen some Australian texts, so maybe Brendan, you can tell me if this is true, but in the United States, a lot of times the word problem is presented as like the final thing of the of the day. And I have a colleague who was telling me about her son's math homework. And it's like, you know, all these math problems at the top. And then there's like one word problem at the bottom. And the teacher like scratched it out, like, oh, you don't have to do that tonight. Probably being trying to be nice to the kids. And she's like, oh, no, we are doing this word problem tonight. But yeah. So like students just don't get enough word problem practice. And I understand that from a teacher point of view. Like I spend a lot of time in classrooms, and teachers are, it's hard to get through everything that they're trying to get through in a day. And the last thing you really want to do is spend 5 or 10 minutes or sometimes 15 minutes setting up and solving a word problem. But as you alluded to a bit earlier, you know, in Australia, students show off their mathematics knowledge through word problem solving, whether that's routine word problem solving or directive word problem solving. And so if students have not practiced this, it's going to be very hard for them to show off all that multiplication knowledge, right? Often it doesn't really matter that much. Can students solve 23 times 4? Can students solve 23 times 4 in a word problem scenario? That's often what's important. And that's also related to real life as well. And so if we're not practicing regularly, and you know, we're not giving students an opportunity to read these problems and understand them and set up and solve them, then it's not a surprise to me when so many students experience some pretty high level of difficulty with word problem solving.
Yeah. And look, going back to your example before around how often, you know, we'll have the end task being to complete a word problem.
Yeah.
Sometimes that can also be a mistake as well, when all it is just a continuation of what has been taught throughout that whole lesson. And so you get those kids, they work out pretty quickly. I still don't have to read the problem because
I'm just
multiply
today. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. And that's kind of where, yeah, like if we had this separate, you know, scope and sequence almost of word problems that we're looking at.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, and use that interleave practice principle. It's going to be a bit more challenging. Yeah. For students. All right. So yeah, going back to your schema instruction, are you able to just go through the multiplicative ones as well?
Yeah. So around third grade, so students 8, 9 years old, there's 2 multiplicative schemas that come into play. One is what we refer to as the equal group schema. So that's where students have groups with an equal number in each group. You know, so that might be that, you know, Brendan has 3 boxes and there's 8 markers in each box. How many markers does he have? And then there's also this multiplicative comparison schema. Some people call that the comparison schema. We sometimes call this the set schema, just to make it a little bit easier to remember. But this is where there's this set that's multiplied a number of times. So it might be that, you know, Brendan sold 12 cookies and Sarah sold 4 times as many cookies as Brendan. You know, how many cookies did Sarah sell? So there's that set of 12, and then you're multiplying that set 4 times. So then as we move through the later elementary grades, then all 5 schema, the ones where you're putting together, I call those total. The one where you're comparing, I call that difference. The one where something changes, we call that change. And then equal groups, where you have groups with an equal number in each group, or the comparison schema where you have a set multiplied a number of times, those are all in play. And if you look at your word problems, either in your textbook or on your state or national exams, you're probably going to find all five of those. And then as students go into the middle school grades, so, you know, around 11, 12 years old, then they start to come into the schema where they may end up working with a ratio or a proportion. And so those then are continue with them through middle school. And then as the students go to high school, there's actually some people that are really starting to dig into the common schemas that you would see in Algebra 1 and Algebra 2. So I'm not as familiar with those, but they say that those do exist. But really across grades K through 8, there are those six schema that are very regularly seen in those routine word problems. And if students know those and know how to solve problems related to those schema, then it just makes word problem solving a much more palatable task and not insurmountable. Brendan, before we've asked students, we work a lot at third, fourth grade in word problem solving, and we'll ask kids, like, how many different types of problems do you think there are? And, you know, a kid's been like, a million and thousands. And it's like, what if I told you there were five? And actually, when I talk with teachers about this, sometimes that's not always evident to them. My niece is in first grade here in the United States, so she's seven. And my sister doesn't mind me telling the story. I will not name the school where my niece goes to school. But my sister went to my niece's parent-teacher conference a few weeks ago. And, you know, my niece, they're like, oh, she's reading really well, but she's struggling with word problem solving. And my sister and I just thought that was hilarious because that's like all I talk about all the time is word problem solving. Yeah. I mean, my career is around word problems. And it's like, of course, you know, your family is always the worst at the thing you're best at. And then my sister said, well, the teacher said we need to practice these 11 problem types at home. And I immediately knew what the teacher was doing because I'm like, 11 is the magic number of the additive schemas. But I think the teacher, and I'm so glad she knows there's problem types, but I'm like, I think we could whittle those 11. They actually fall into three categories. So there's two problem types that fall into total. That's total with the unknown and total with the part unknown. And then there's three that fall into difference. And then there's six that fall into change. And so then, you know, it's Saturday night, my sister and I are setting up and solving these word problems. And Abby's like, oh, that's so much easier. And I'm like, yeah, it is. And so, yeah. So I'm like, really great that teachers are aware of the problem types, but there's kind of like some next level knowledge of then being able to organize them in a way that I think is more accessible for students.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And,
yeah,
you know, like you've spoken a lot about how complex all of this is, and it's going to be a lot, I guess, simpler for students to understand if we do it in a systematic manner.
Yeah.
How important is fluency in all of this, that, you know, students actually have fluency in their basic maths class?
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, I always want to think about fluency as just doing things easily and accurately. And there's parts of fluency that do, as I always talk with teachers, like that will eventually track toward automaticity, but there's a lot of fluency that's just ease and accuracy. And, you know, really fluency is everything in mathematics, but counting fluency is important. Fact fluency is absolutely essential. Fluency with computation is important as well. And all of those are important for word problem solving. So yeah, if it's 6 + 5 and a student has to, you know, first, yeah, count out 6 objects and count out 5 objects and put them all together. And yeah, let's do that the first few times we're solving this problem. But eventually, I'd like you to start at 6 and count forward 5. Or eventually, it would be great if you knew that 6 + 5 is 11. And that's particularly important when then the next word problem is 26 + 35. And so having a strategy to be able to approach that multi-digit computation. And then within that, you know, 26 + 35, 6 + 5 is an integral part of that. So 6 + 5 is 11. That's going to make solving that problem easier. And so, yeah, the fluency piece is really important to develop alongside the word problem solving piece, because when students don't have fluency, it slows them down. You know, it really like taxes working memory and slows their processing speed. And also causes a halt to the problem solving process, where if they're like, oh, 6 + 5 is 11, boom, all right, great, great. Did you answer the question? Wonderful. Let's go on to the next thing. Then the problem solving is going to be more fluent because their fluency skill is more fluent.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And
do you see in Australia that students have difficulty with facts and computational fluency?
Definitely, yeah. And it's probably another key aspect when we're looking at those areas which a lot of our students have difficulties with. I'd say fluency is right up there as to being one of those main problems. And like what you're talking about there, like it's just so important in kind of not putting as much pressure on their working memory when they are going through these word problems when, you know, even if they have that understanding of schema instruction, like this is still like one extra step that they have to put into play.
Yeah. When you have to really slow down and think about, well, what's 3 times 8 and draw that out, you know, at the beginning, I don't want to say like they have to know that as we start problem solving, but at the beginning, we are going to draw that out and we are going to, you know, model with manipulatives or virtual tools. But it's like eventually 3 times 8, I'd love, you know, it'd be great if you know that's 24 because there's another step to this problem. And now you're going to have to do 24 minus 3. And so at any point when students don't have that fluency with facts and computation, it just really slows the whole thing down. Or maybe sometimes it comes to a screeching halt. And then it's like, oh, where was I? Oh, there's a whole second step to this. I totally forgot that because I was out modeling 3 times 8.
During the planning phase of the attack strategy, what sort of things can we actually be doing, you know, in terms of like we've spoken briefly about bar modeling, you know, how does bar modeling fit in and what other techniques could students be using?
Yeah, this is such a good question. I like love your questions about word problem solving. So thank you for being so like understanding of problem solving. So we do a few things. So once we read a problem with students and usually like, what's this problem about? Okay, this problem is about turtles. All right, cool. What are the turtles doing? You know, and there's some kind of like, oh, it looks like the turtles are, some of them are going back into the pond. Then we usually will be like, okay, let's think about what kind of problem this is. And so then this is where we'll introduce a schema question, often paired with a schema gesture. And the gesture kind of helps students visualize what's going on in the problem. And so for the schemas that are used in the elementary grades, we often will say, okay, well, we just read this story. Is it a total story where parts are put together for a total? And if students are like, yeah, we're like, okay, let's solve it as a total story. I'm like, if they say no, you're like, okay, I have another question for you. Is this a different story? Are two amounts compared for a difference? If not, is this a change story? Does one amount increase or decrease? If not, is this an equal group story? Are there groups with this equal number in each group? And if not, you'd be like, is this a set story? Is there a set multiplied a number of times? And that question, often students are like, oh yeah, no, there's a set. I see. I've got this set of cookies and it's multiplying a few times. Like that really helps them think about that. And then tied to that gets to what you were just talking about with like bar models or other graphic organizers. So then once you understand, let's just say in this problem, I have this set multiplied a number of times, then students should have something to organize the information for that schema. Often for the set schema, we use the equation S times T equals P, set times times equals product. And so we're like, okay, write your equation. And then once you have that there, then students can take the information from the problem and use it to construct an equation that represents that problem. You can also do that with a bar model. Oh, okay, I see my total is 11 and I've got this part that represents 6. So here on the other part of this model, I need to figure out that unknown information. And so those graphic organizers, like a bar model or equations, are a real helpful kind of like second step to your planning. First, your planning is, well, what's going on in the story? And then second is, what can I use to help students organize the information now knowing that it's a total, difference, change, equal groups, or set story?
For as little as the price of a cup of coffee each month, I would really appreciate it if you supported the Knowledge for Teachers podcast. While the podcast will always be available for free, your support will ensure the sustainability of it. By doing so, you will gain access to transcripts, my key takeaways from each episode, and more. So, if you can head to patreon.com/knowledgeforteacherspodcast, that would be greatly appreciated. If you are a larger organization interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact me at brendan@learnwithlee.net. Now, let's get back to the episode. Really get into the decision-making of a teacher. How important is that planning phase? You know, because you're always going to have those kids that are like, I already know the answer, and you're just going to go straight there.
Yeah.
Like, do we want to be slowing those kids down, or are we okay with the fact that they can just tell us the answer?
Oh, that's a good question, and I have two ideas around that. One is the planning phase is almost everything in word problem solving, and I will often, when I work with groups of teachers on trying to help them understand attack strategies and schemas, I'll say like the setting up of the word problem is the most difficult thing. Often the solving, the computation, once we get students there, we're like, okay, we're over the hill. Like there's just a little bit more. And that the setting up is hard because they have to read and understand it. What's going on in the story? What information do I need? What information do I not need? That's a lot that goes into that. And so the planning part is really essential for students. So, but that being said, you're right. Like you're going to have sometimes students are like, oh, it's 11. You're like, great. And I would be like, how did you know that? And you know, what was going on in the story that indicated that you needed to figure that out? But, you know, often it's 11 now, but soon it's going to be 78. And then later on, it's going to be 342. And, you know, as the math gets more complex, the planning is more important. And so for some students, if you're just like, say it's 11, you know, maybe one or two problems, I'd be like, tell me how you did that. But then I would be like, all right, this time we're going to go through this. We're going to use this bar model. We're going to fill it in. I know you know it's 11, but I still want to see if you understand the components of this problem. Because very soon, it's not always going to be a problem where you add to figure out the answer. And it's not always going to be a problem that is just 5 plus 6. Pretty soon you're going to be doing with this with fractions and you don't know that. And that's going to make this problem more complex. And so as students go into those more complex problems and those multi-step, multi-schema problems, really having that planning piece down is going to make them more successful in problem solving as they move through the grades.
Yeah, that's really good advice there, because I think it's a step that a lot of teachers can get a bit stuck on, and knowing like, sometimes we can get a bit confused as to like, what is the purpose of this question right now? Like, do we just want them to get the answer right, mm-hmm. or do we want a little bit more than that? And so I think the way that you've described, you know, this is the whole of maths, this is what it's all about. They need to be able to kind of reason and describe how they've got this answer, because I think as you mentioned there, for a lot of word problems they could probably fluke the right answer if they just put it into an equation, and so if they're not able to reason, then they're not actually conceptually understanding what the problem's about.
Brendan, in Australia, are students in schools writing about mathematics, explaining their work?
It's like consistently, being asked of students across.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're seeing that more in the United States. About 24 of the 50 states right now are asking students to also write in mathematics. But even if it's not formally, you know, there's this whole idea of being able to reason and explain in mathematics. And, you know, students might be asked by their teacher, like, oh, turn and talk to somebody and tell them how you solved this problem, right? And I think that when you're getting at that level of explanation, particularly if it's through a lens of math writing, we see a lot of things that are like, solve the problem and then explain with, you know, words and sentences how you solve the problem. And, you know, a very basic explanation is I had 5 and I had 6 and I added it together. A much better explanation as well, I saw that Brendan had these cookies and Sarah had another part of cookies, and I had to add them all together to figure out how many cookies they had in total, right? So, you know, if teachers are trying to get students to that next level explanation, the schemas can just be a real natural way to think about those explanations instead of always just describing, oh, I'm multiplying or I'm dividing or I'm adding or subtracting. And I also will say, I'm sorry to interrupt you. There's a lot of problems where, like even in the example that I gave, like Brendan and Sarah have 11 cookies. If Brendan has 6, how many cookies does Sarah have? Often you'll set that up into an equation like 6 plus blank equals 11. But some students would be 11 minus 6 to figure out 5. But other students might start at 6 and add on to make 11. Mm. So you can subtract to solve that problem. You can also add. And so it's for that reason that I really try to not describe word problems by their operation, because you might subtract and I might add, and we're both correct. And, you know, I think in mathematics, we're always trying to help students see that there's multiple ways to solve the same problem. And so for that reason, I couldn't say like, today we're working on subtraction word problems, because it actually isn't a subtraction word problem. That's a total problem. And I may end up subtracting or I may end up adding, but the deeper understanding of that word problem is that I have these parts put together for a total. I have an unknown part and I know the total and one of the other parts.
Yeah, that's a really great point there. For students who are operating below grade level, what can we be doing to support them?
Yeah, well, that's where we spend a lot of our time. So introducing the schemas to students, even if it seems like they're, that might be complex for them, but you can introduce the schemas with simpler set numbers and then work in more grade level numbers to these problems. But also just providing a lot of supports like you normally would. So when we do small group or individual tutoring, we're almost always reading these problems alongside the students. Also getting them to use, like if they're using technology that has the word problems, you know, using the reader on the technology to have the problem read aloud. And you can reread it multiple times. And then having a lot of conversations, like what's going on in this story? What's the story about? You know, what do you notice that's in this story? Is there information that you see? Do you think there's information that's unknown or missing? So having a lot of conversations. But then I'd say two things that are really kind of adjacent to word problem solving that are important for all learners, but particularly struggling learners. Building math vocabulary is really key here. There's a lot of the same words in these word problems again and again. So what does it mean if you have more than, or what does it mean if there's fewer? Like, and if you have fewer of something, what does that mean? But then as we've already talked about, the fluency piece is really important. So I don't want students, you know, trouble with thinking about adding 23 plus 47 to be the prohibiting factor in solving a word problem correctly. So, you know, outside of your word problem practice, also practicing that fact and computational fluency, also really emphasizing the language of math, those things are going to help struggling learners have like better access to word problem solving.
Yeah, that's, again, I like your point there on the vocabulary in maths as well, where
that
can be a massive sticking point for a lot of our students. You know, in general, for students that struggle in maths, they're probably going to be struggling in reading as well a lot of the times. And so, if they're struggling with actually understanding the question on top of the fluency, well, there's no wonder that they're feeling overwhelmed and switching off when it comes to these problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's where kids, you know, sometimes the keyword strategy that we talked about 30 minutes ago, you know, sometimes teachers haven't introduced that. It could be that parents or caregivers introduced it, but it also could be that kids made that connection on their own. They're like, huh, that's weird. Every time I see total, I add. And so they may not have the poster in the classroom, but maybe they've just said, oh, okay, that's all I need to do here. And that may have been the first 20 or 30 times they ever saw total in a word problem. Yeah, they added. And this gets the whole thing of like, well, we need to have more variable practice for students and we don't need to have these very like formulaic and mechanical word problems, because when we use total all the time when the total's missing, then students do track into that keyword pitfall. And so just making sure that students haven't started to make those connections on their own that aren't correct. And we see the same thing with like students will think like, oh, every time you add, you know, your answer is going to be greater. Well, that's not always going to be true when we get to like, you know, positive and negative integers and rational numbers and all of those things. And so, well, especially with multiplication and, you know, and so on. So it's like these, there's some really great articles by Karen Karp and colleagues where they talk about the rules that expire. And so thinking about some of those rules and how they may play out in problem solving, that's going to be important as well.
Mm. So it's been a really fascinating conversation today. I've loved digging into word problems. As we get towards the end of this conversation, are there any final words that you'd like to say about word problems that might help teachers with implementing their teaching of word problems more effectively?
Yeah, well, like teacher knowledge around attack strategies and schemas is really important. And I will say, as a person who when I taught school, I definitely taught kids to find keywords and use those to solve word problems. So I, you know, didn't do the right thing at some point. But it takes a little bit of time to change how you think about word problems. Because as adults, we can like just even glance at a word problem and say like, oh, I'm going to multiply or I'm going to subtract. Go back to not knowing that and being aware of the schemas. It takes a little bit of time to retrain your brain. So, you know, reading about the schemas, doing, you know, activities where you try to categorize word problems by schemas and looking at the resources that your students are using, whether those are texts or tests, and what are the common scenarios and concepts that you see emphasized again and again. So I think doing some work on the front end so that then when you're in the class and you read a word problem, it's really obvious to you it's a change problem and here's why, or it's really obvious that it's an equal groups problem and here's why. Like the teacher knowledge piece is big. And it takes a while to move away from operation into schema. So give yourself a month or two to really read up and become familiar with those things. But in that time, when you're learning a little bit more about the schemas, if you're not that familiar with them, the attack strategy is something you can start doing on Monday. You know, like find an attack strategy. Every time you see a word problem, say, okay, students, we're going to solve this problem, or we're going to UPS check this, or we're going to use shines or ride or ride or redraw right, whatever your attack strategy is. That's kind of the lower hanging fruit. And then the schemas is the more complex thing. So I don't think you have to bite it all off at one time and just like, oh, we got to do this next week. But think about a more step-by-step approach in terms of attack strategy first, and then you combine that attack strategy with a focus on the schemas.
Yeah, great tips there. And I like how you kind of went back to being understanding of the change for the teacher as well, which can just so difficult to change the way that you teach something while learning it on the run. It's something I talk a lot about on this podcast we're constantly asking teachers to, you know, improve their knowledge. And then while they're still at that novice phase as a learner, implement that in their classroom in front of a live audience. It's a tough
gig. It's hard. It's really hard. Well, and when I really got into this word problem stuff with one of my colleagues who helped me write one of the first interventions where we dug into this, we had a lot of debates. Like, is that a total problem or a change problem with an increase? And, you know, and really talking about, oh, well, in this situation, there's an action and this one there's not. So this is why. But now, like, I've done it so much that I can't look at a word problem without seeing the schema. So I think that like, once you do this a lot, you're like, oh yeah, that's a difference problem. Or, oh yeah, that's total. Or that's equal groups. I don't even think about the operation now. I really think about the schema. So my brain has been, you know, retrained.
Yeah. Are there any like websites at all that have a bunch of problems divided up into their actual schemas?
Yeah. So we have done a lot of intervention development work. So we have a program which is called Pirate Math Equation Quest. And that there you can visit our website. Right now we have a lot of materials for the total difference, change, and equal group schema. And this summer we'll complete adding the fifth one. So we'll have total difference, change, equal groups, and the set schema. And there's a bunch of lesson guides and problems that you can download for free. And we also, the thing that I think teachers like the most in the supplemental materials, there's these things we call ship shape sorting cards, and it's hundreds of cards with word problems on them. And students can read the cards and solve them. Or what we ask students to do is read the cards and just tell us what the schema is. And on the back, they're all labeled by schema. So we have a lot of those that are free for download. And you can find those a lot of other places out there on the internet, but those are some that my research team and I have created. So that's a pretty easy resource to share with your listeners.
Yeah, look, I've had a look on the website and it looks terrific. So yeah, I'll definitely add that to the notes as well. Sarah, what can listeners look out for you in the future? What are you working on? What's exciting you?
Yeah. So we are just finishing a study on multi-step problem solving, and we've been testing out over the last 3 years which approach to multi-step problem solving is more helpful for students. And so in one approach, we've been using like two equations to solve a two-step problem. And then in the other approach, we've been using a single equation to represent a problem. So we've been teaching students about parentheses and then order of the operations. And right now, both the approaches are kind of tied in terms of whether they lead to positive word problem outcomes. But those materials will be available for like free download starting summer of 2024. So I'm really into that. And then the other thing that I've been getting into, which maybe we could talk about another time, really we're working with teachers on supporting teachers for bringing in research validated practices into the classroom. So what does an effective model of professional development and coaching look like in terms of teachers trying to, I'll say, boost some of their use of those research validated practices in the classroom. So really gotten into the teacher piece over the last 2 or 3 years. And it's real fun working with teachers and going into their classrooms and then seeing how they're using some of the things that we focus on in coaching and professional development sessions. So those are things that are getting me excited, among a lot of other things, but I'll stop there.
Well, I'll definitely take you up on that offer because that's the space that I'm working in is doing a lot of that, professional learning and coaching and working in school. So it sounds super interesting. Sarah, just to wrap up today though, what other bits of knowledge or resources would you recommend for teachers?
Oh gosh, well the things from the Center for Independent Studies, they actually have a lot of other documents, but the two in maths we had the honor of completing for them over the last year or two. Here in the United States, I've put together a lot of free resources for the National Center on Intensive Intervention. That's a U.S. National Center. And you can visit their website at intensiveintervention.org. But many of the things that we talked about here today, particularly around word problem solving, I've made free videos with embedded activities where teachers, if they want to learn more about word problem solving or fluency building or use of representations, they can watch those videos and do the activities to try to, as we talked about earlier, Brendan, boost their content knowledge related to these topics. And I have a few other resources I'll send along to you, but those are some of the more popular ones.
Amazing. Thank you for today, Sarah. I know you've had a really busy week. So thank you for your energy and enthusiasm and knowledge about how teachers can really address word problems and teach them effectively. So thank you for your time and looking forward to meeting up again sometime.
I look forward to it. And thanks for your focus on maths. It's just so important. And so many students have difficulty with it. And it doesn't really need to be as difficult for students as it is. So thank you for focusing on it today and in many other ways.
Thank you.
I'm hoping that we can really start to take a more evidence-informed approach towards teaching students how to attack word problems. And I feel Sarah was really able to unpack how to do it. Here are my key takeaways. Trying to design a task that has 30 different students engaging with productive struggle is extremely challenging to do effectively. Word problems are a type of problem-solving activity, and there are routine, non-routine, and directive word problems. For Year 3 students, the average number of words that they have to read for a word problem is 22 words for a single question, so they really need to be fluent readers and have a strong understanding of maths vocabulary. In multi-step word problems, keywords help less than 10% of the time. Attack strategies and schema instruction can support students' understanding of word problems. Introduce each schema separately and provide practice opportunities before starting a new type. Schema instruction can start as soon as they begin looking at addition. However, you just don't start naming the schemas yet. We need to provide daily word problem practice to improve students' fluency in problem solving. Next episode, you will hear from the amazing Tom Bennett, and not only does he deliver on providing expert advice on behavior management, but he has some absolutely cracking stories to tell. However, that's it from me for today. And as always, stay curious, keep learning, and teach with purpose. Bye for now.